I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of medical news site HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. Welcome back to the flagship podcast station for HCPLive.com, a comprehensive clinical news and resource site for every specialty and subject in medicine. You can check out our specialty-specific podcast series on HCP Live, including Lungcast, hosted by the American Lung Association, Derm Discussions, hosted by practicing dermatologist Dr. Brad Glick, and Heartbeats with Duke University's Dr. Manish Patel. We've got new episodes for two of the three launching in the coming week, so it's a great time to catch up on the series. Just a reminder that you can follow HCP Live on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and subscribe for top stories and expert insights with our HCPLive.com newsletter. We're a couple of days away from kicking off live coverage at the American Society of Hematology 2021 meeting, so follow us for updates in hematology, rare cancers, gene therapy, and more. Today's episode of Doc Talk, though, dives into the medical subject dominating headlines and probably your own conversations at this moment: the threat and spread of the Omicron variant. Though we're currently in a state where much is still being learned about how the newest COVID variant of concern infects and burdens patients, as well as how our available vaccines and treatments fare against it, global and federal authorities are moving quick to respond against the threat. There's dozens of multifactorial public health and clinical worries to address with Omicron, just as there were with Delta and previous variants. So in this time of uncertainty, we turn to as confident an expert we know. Our friend, Dr. Donald Alcindor, wears many hats on various COVID response teams. He's a well-regarded vaccinologist and immunologist from Meharry Medical College and Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, as well as an experienced public health advocate and community outreach planner. He's even served as an expert advisor to the FDA. And though he doesn't have a magic eight ball when it comes to assessing the Omicron variant threat, he has as good perspective as anyone on what we should be doing at the public health, clinical, and laboratory levels. We hope all your questions about this variant of concern are answered in this new episode of Doc Talk. Okay, so Dr. Alcindor, just as we were saying before we got going here, the United States has encountered its first known case of the Omicron variant, SARS-CoV-2's newest variant of concern in the U.S. after first being observed in Africa just about a week ago now. Obviously, it's a recurring discussion that we've been having with previous variants of concern, including the Delta variant, where we're dealing with a most likely more transmissible risk here, something that people are concerned will compromise the efficacy of our available mRNA vaccines. But a lot of research obviously ongoing, a lot of discussions still happening. And in the meantime, some federal mandates and discussions about travel restrictions, masking, and so on up in the air right now as we're trying to approach this more carefully and avoid, a winter season similar to last year, right? So I just wanted to start off first and foremost, Dr. Alcindor, and ask for your perspective on, what's the understood risk of the Omicron variant right now? And what more do we need to know?
Yes, what I can say is that it's totally unknown right now, but what they're seeing is that they're seeing mutations that are characteristic of mutations that can lead to some level of immune evasion and some level of increased transmissibility in this new variant. However, what we've seen with the Delta variant, the Alpha, Beta, and Gamma is that the protection that we've seen with the initial vaccine, we have seen at the level of no severe disease, no hospitalizations, but reduced hospitalizations and, of course, death. So when we look at what a vaccine is supposed to do, this vaccine that we have now, the current vaccine, has protected us from four different variants of concern. That is Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta. And again, there's many people that believe that it will protect us against the Omicron variant as well. Again, the data is still not there. The jury's still out. And so the evidence suggests that from data from Israel suggests that the Omicron variant will be susceptible to the immune protection provided by the current vaccines. And so I think this becomes now a laboratory exercise, meaning that you have to take the Omicron variant, culture it in cells in a petri dish, and then you have to use serum that contains antibodies from a given individual that has been immunized against COVID-19 with the original vaccines. And then you will have to find out how well the antibodies in that person's serum can protect those cells in a petri dish from getting infected by the Omicron virus. And that would give you an idea of the immune protection against the variant.
Right. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Alcindor. And really feeding into, I guess, the key worry that we're going to be hearing from the public, obviously, at a time when booster doses are becoming more widely available and our hands sort of being forced here in terms of authorization and I guess CDC and FDA recommendation for all adults to be eligible for booster dose vaccines after 6 months full immunization. Obviously, people are concerned because we're living in a world where, the confidence of a full vaccination implied by clinical trial data showing about 95% efficacy, 90% efficacy, varying a little bit, again, for some of these stronger variants that we've encountered, but nonetheless, highly efficacious vaccines relative to other prophylaxis right. that are available. Is this something that we need to, I guess, alter our approach or our public acceptance of the limitations of vaccines, or is this something that's just been a reality all along that we haven't really perceived well because, again, of this vaccine efficacy, this big, broad headline number that we've been operating with since the beginning?
Yeah. So even starting out with the high efficacy rates of the mRNA vaccines in the mid-90s, what has become concern is that these efficacy rates start to drop off after 6 months. And what they had seen, and this is data coming out of Israel, of the high level of breakthrough infections that they've seen in people that have gotten their vaccinations, their initial doses, 6 months prior. And again, the strategy to go after expanding the boosters to 18 and older, again, this was a precautionary measure, I believe, by the administration so that they could somehow curtail the likelihood of increased breakthrough infections in the future. And again, this Omicron variant just reminds us that we're not done with this virus yet, and this virus is ever changing, and that it is essential that the unvaccinated in our communities become vaccinated. And at the same time, we have to make sure that there is vaccine equity in the global community, meaning that we will continue to see the evolution of variants in different parts of the world if different parts of the world are not vaccinated. And so this is something that's going to be ongoing, but I don't think it's going to be difficult, I think, down the road to booster our way out of this pandemic. We simply have to establish a way that vaccine manufacturing and vaccine distribution happens in developing countries that will allow large-scale vaccinations in the way we saw with the World Health Organization joining in with all nations to provide vaccines for polio and so forth. And so we have to take this very serious because the next variant can come out of another place that remains unvaccinated. And so when we look at these poor resource countries, they simply don't have the money to purchase vaccine contracts like rich countries can. And so vaccine contracts are purchased far in advance to when a vaccine is actually produced. And so I think we have to find a way to provide equity in the global community for vaccinations for COVID-19.
And I'm glad that's what you mentioned, because that was my next question was, we have this fluctuating, I guess, debate and sense of prioritization as you're speaking to, a lot of dissent in the VRBPAC meetings and the advisory discussions around booster dose authorizations was their necessity relative to these doses being more applicable, as you're saying, to lower income countries and regions with worse healthcare access. And as you're pointing out, very aptly, obviously, Africa among the least immunized, continents, regions, a series of countries in our entire world. And this is where, thankfully, monitoring is active enough that we are, observing variants coming out of there. But it has been frequently an issue for them. It's been a great burden for them. And I guess that does answer my next question of exactly how do we better address, variant mitigation? And if it's just broader immunization, even if it's less efficacious than, say, a fully, booster dosed nation.
I want to add to that, And I think it's very important that we make a sincere, concerted effort to expand genomic sequencing
right.
at the level that will allow us to address the evolution of variants in real time.
Yeah.
And the idea is that we all know that as long as you wait, people are constantly traveling. This is an infection that doesn't present clinical symptoms in most people, but they're still infected. And they can transmit that infection. Knowing that you have a new variant as soon as possible is the best strategy in terms of dealing with it. And of course, it may not mean travel restrictions. It may mean something different if you're able to understand the evolution of these variants and maybe even come to a point where you have predicted value in terms of when is and where the next variant is likely to come from.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that too, because it wasn't even a calendar year ago when I was speaking with some national representatives of the genomic sequencing campaigns in the US and learning very unfortunately from team members in New Mexico, UPMC, LSU, that our genomic sequencing strategies in the US are not fully calibrated. They're not fully bridged. Our communication lines are mostly improvised, which is a very troubling, revelation at that point, a full year into the pandemic. And at this point, you know, heading into 2 years, I'm curious to ask you, Dr. Alexander, with this newest threat. And again, that discussion that we had just before this about people's interpretation of the first Omicron variant case has been observed in the U.S. It's like, yes, observed, definitely not the first, but the first observed. I want to ask you what the current status is of our genomic sequencing strategies and communication. Is this something that's been better streamlined so far?
Is the thing. The government has come in with funding to support that. Sure. And they're sequencing, mm-hmm. but they're not sequencing at the level that they should still at this time. Mm-hmm. It's much better than before. But again, you're still looking at a kind of scattered effort. You know what I'm saying? And I think what you have to do is come together as a group, you know what I'm saying? And have, I would say, regional sequencing platforms that might be in the north, east, west, and south of the United States, where you have a continual flow of specimens coming in, and they have the manpower and the resources to be able to process those samples and get that information out quickly. And of course, share that information with people around the world in basically connections that run global in terms of sequence information that becomes available. And again, this has to be funded at a level that can bring it up to a level that will be useful in terms of being able to identify variants in as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And I want to ask you too on that note of just better, I guess, public response measures that could be possibly put in place. One of the things that obviously the Biden administration as of yesterday was discussing was a better availability of in-home testing capability. It'd be able to at least get rapid antigen tests, assays more available in, pharmacies and more, just more available for the general population. There's also the discussion around the fact that this is a significantly, starkly different a winter season that we're approaching relative to last year, where masking mandates were still in place, a lot of closures of businesses still, and people hold in a little bit, nonetheless visiting each other during the holidays and really triggering that significant outbreak that we were seeing over the winter season, but a little less so enough to make a difference in things like our flu season. With the emergence of this variant now, and obviously flu season becoming, I guess, a more applicable threat as it used to be relative to last year, I wanted to ask about the importance of testing availability and access and people's utility of that, prioritization of that as a resource.
Yeah. And so when I think about the antigen test becoming more available to people, mm-hmm. it has to become more affordable, particularly for underserved yes. communities. You see what I'm saying? Yes. And I think you have to understand that the antigen tests is not designed to detect acute infection in terms of antibodies that would be to the virus. So you could have people that have asymptomatic disease testing positive to the antigen test, and then you ask yourself, what does that mean? It means that they've been exposed to the virus. Test designed for you to determine if a person has acute disease, and it's designed for you to determine if a person has been able to clear the virus, you see. And so an antigen test just gives you exposure. Now, what the antigen test can do is that it can give you an indication of the level of exposure within a given population. And that's important because it can tell you how many people, what is the incidence of infection in this particular neighborhood, in this particular county. You see what I'm saying? But again, you're still burdened with the fact that some people, that is people that are vaccine hesitant, vaccine resistant, and those that are anti-vaxxers, they're going to refuse to take an antigen test in my mind. And so we've seen this at a high level, particularly here in Tennessee. There are 95 counties in Tennessee. 70 of them are rural counties, more than 70 probably. And it turns out that there is a high level of vaccine hesitancy and resistance in these rural counties. And again, this is something we've seen that is characteristic throughout the South, where in these rural counties, you see low level of vaccine acceptance. You see more than likely these counties, you have children that are coming from families that are vaccine hesitant. And again, that concerns me in terms of going forward to vaccinate 28 million children that have been added to the vaccine rolls. This will also become difficult going forward, but we have to do it.
Thank you for that, Dr. Alcindor. And then it just lastly speaking to, I mean, obviously we're working in a more capable space in terms of our COVID-19 mitigation, and not just at the preventive level, obviously vaccination. We're approaching about 60% full immunization in the US population. And that's not even speaking to the pediatric population that we've yet to address full vaccine availability for just yet. I'm also speaking to here, of course, actual treatment strategies and regimens and therapies that have been authorized and better clinically proven to mitigate the threat of COVID-19. We're working with, antivirals and monoclonal antibodies that can really nip in the bud the risk of severe disease in patients, and hopefully accomplish what we hope for all along here, which is to keep our hospitals clear. I wanted to ask about your optimism, or guess just, or if it's not optimistic, your outlook on our opportunity to keep our hospital resources and emergent care resources, under much better control this winter season heading into this latest development in COVID.
I think maintain mitigation strategies.
Yeah.
I think it's very important.
Yeah.
A strong, concerted effort to vaccinate the unvaccinated. I'm saying mandates is something that's an option. Mm-hmm. But one thing we should say about mandates is that mandates have been known to work. Mm-hmm. And they should be on the table as an option. Because I have been embedded with vaccinators to vaccinate a very large company that you would know of if I mentioned it. And this company employs thousands and thousands of employees. Their level of vaccine uptake is about 46% throughout their facilities and warehouses. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's unacceptable. And what I'm concerned about is pockets of unvaccinated people spread throughout the United States that are going to stay unvaccinated and allow the continual transmission and evolution of variants within those communities. And so mitigation strategies for people that are unvaccinated is absolutely essential. Boosters, and again, boosters, I think, should be considered to be targeted in some way. Sure. Making them available for people 18 and above, I think, was a risk strategy for risk reduction. And I think if a person has gone 6 months with their initial vaccinations with the mRNA, and of course with Johnson & Johnson, I think the option to get a booster simply would allow them to have added protection in place if a new variant like this Omicron variant comes along and is sufficiently able to avoid immune responses to the initial vaccines,
right.
I think you'd have protection on board. So again, this would, in my mind, is a risk mitigation strategy to expand boosters for people 18 and older. I think that it will help. I think at the same time, you're looking at places like Africa, where you have almost 8 billion doses given out, and only 0.6% of those doses have been given to people in that particular country. Right. You have to ask yourself, we are likely to be looking at our fourth shot. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so I think people are looking at this and saying, wait a minute. You know, we have to do something about this going forward. We will not be able to vaccinate ourselves out of a pandemic in-house because we live in a community.
Yeah, yeah. And that's honestly what it all really ties back into is, you know, our strategies need to be selfless, which is counterintuitive in respect to most people's, I guess, prioritizations of healthcare, of course, and it's something that's, you know, misinterpreted with masking and social distancing mandates is, you know, you're not trying to protect yourself as much as you are trying to protect those around you. It's something that's sort of lost in the conceptualization. And vaccines are such a individualized choice and unfortunately such a politicized measure currently that it is taken from the fullest extent of a selfish strategy. And unfortunately that messaging is lost. So maybe if we could just end on this note, Dr. Alexander, if there's any, you know, sincere, direct public health messaging that you could provide to both your peers and for the public and, you know, looking to be better told what they should be doing right now with this news of the Omicron variant, what would it be?
I would say that if you're fully vaccinated, the chances are that you're going to be protected against the Omicron variant if it comes to the United States in the kind of numbers that would take over the existing Delta variant. Mm-hmm. I think if you're eligible for the booster, you should get your booster shot. Mm-hmm. More so than anything I can say this morning would be if you're sitting there and you're unvaccinated, you mm-hmm. should be able to have the greatest concern. And the idea is that if you have eligible children, that is 7-5 and older, they should be vaccinated as well. I say to those people that continually refuse to be vaccinated and are steadfast in their beliefs, they should honor and participate in CDC mitigation strategies to protect themselves and others. You don't want to be a vector.
Absolutely. That's very well put. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Alexander. Is there anything else you want to add relative to Omicron or just the current status of COVID-19?
I think this virus has challenged us in many ways. Every time we have turned the corner, this virus has shown us that it has been relentless in terms of making us work harder to control it. In the end, this virus more than likely will become endemic in the United States. We, at one time, we thought warm weather would take care of this virus for us.
Yeah.
We have been behind in our messaging to support vaccination and mitigation strategies against this virus from the beginning. We have been playing catch up for a long time, and we have paid a high price with 775,000 people dying of COVID-19.
Yeah.
And it continues to be that way. And every now and then we have another breaking news about something else that is surprising about this virus. We need to make a stand, and we need to come to a point that we all understand that we have to vaccinate the unvaccinated in order to make the difference we need to get this virus under control.
Thanks again to Dr. Alexander for joining us. For more COVID-19 coverage and new perspectives on Omicron and vaccination, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com or follow us on social media. Until next time, I'm Kevin Kunzman with HCP Live. Thanks for listening to Doc Talk.